Welcome, welcome to Maximus Call-In Radio Show. This is episode 45. Welcome our loyal listeners who may be listening on Clubhouse, YouTube, and Instagram Live. And welcome to especially new listeners who are listening on Clubhouse as we begin to expand on this platform. My name is Dr. Cam Sapa. I am a licensed clinical psychologist and psychiatry professor at UCSF Medical School. And I have a practice specializing in health and performance optimization. I coach CEOs and VCs. And I also run a company called Maximus, which you can find at MaximusTribe.com, that does prescription hormone optimization. We use doctor-prescribed drugs, labs, and meds to optimize and double men's testosterone levels in a way that's safe and effective. All right, so we like to start every show with what I like to call a weekly unpopular opinion. And this is actually inspired by a question that was submitted via our Discord, actually. I'm actually just going to pull it up right here. So the question, this was asked by a user, Thorgi, is Athletic Greens worth it, specifically this brand? So if you're not familiar with Athletic Greens, it's a supplement. I won't really speak on Athletic Greens. I'll talk about sort of the whole powdered greens market, because there's a million brands that actually sell these sort of powdered greens. You can buy them at Amazon, even Trader Joe's these days. And they're kind of funny products, to be honest, from a health perspective, because they're not quite foods. They don't have enough protein to really be a meal replacement, like a protein powder would be, or a previous company that I started called Actualize. You can check that one out. It's goactualize.com. Use the code MaximusMeal for 10% off. That is actually a complete meal replacement, meaning it has all the macronutrients, meaning protein, fat, and it's low carb, and the micronutrients, meaning it actually has all of the vitamins that if you theoretically consumed a day's worth, like 2,000 calories worth, it's actually nutritionally complete. These powdered green supplements are not that case. They only have like 2 grams of protein, so you can't really use them as a meal replacement. So really what they are is that they're a supplement, but they're kind of a weird mix of kind of a plant-based extracts, and they're mostly based on spirulina, which is kind of like a blue-green algae that's grown in the water. And then they throw in some very random vitamins in there. So they'll throw in vitamin K and coenzyme Q10. And so to me, I actually don't like overly complex products because the likelihood of having sort of interactions with other things, and especially if you're taking vitamins on top of it, it's not really great. Like most people take like a daily multivitamin. If you're adding that on top of your Athletic Greens or any other green supplement on top of your multivitamin, you may end up taking let's say too much vitamin K2. The other problem with it is they don't tell you even how much is in it, because it's a proprietary supplement. So it just says there's a complex of raw superfoods, whatever that means, 7,388 milligrams. You have no idea how much of each is in there, other than the fact that a nutritional label, generally the highest quantity is the first thing that's labeled. So it has the most spirulina, let's say, compared to all the other ingredients, but you don't know how much spirulina is in there. Just like I said, you don't know how much vitamin K and all these other vitamins are in there as well. So it's kind of a messy supplement, to be honest with you. And I don't like it because the risk of running over in terms of like the necessary quantity of vitamins is high if you take a bunch of other supplements or vitamins. The second thing is I actually question the whole function of it. Like a lot of people, the reason they take a green supplement is because they've heard that greens are good, right? Vegetables are good for you. I don't eat 5 vegetables a day, and thus let me take this powdered supplement to get away with the fact that I don't eat a salad, or I don't eat much other than a salad, let's say. And I don't think you should think about supplements that way. You shouldn't use a supplement to make up for essentially a food problem in the first place. And if it was so easy to replace, salads with a scoop of a powdered product, everyone would be doing it. And I don't think it quite works, quite frankly, that way. The first premise that I would like to question in regards to that is I have a controversial opinion that vegetables are a nice to have and not a need to have as they're built. And I can actually empirically I point to some strong evidence for that, which is if you look at hunter-gatherers, which are one of the few remaining, you know, cultures that still eat an ancestral diet, they really don't eat vegetables. There's been a published analysis. You can look on my Twitter. It's Dr. Cam RX. I actually cite the specific studies that look at what hunter-gatherers eat, and they mostly eat meat, obviously, is the base of their diet in terms of their protein intake. They eat honey as a carbohydrate source because it's like quick, delicious energy, essentially. They eat tubers, which are basically like below ground vegetables. Think about like a sweet potato, a yam, a radish, things of that nature. They eat berries if they're in season. And they eat particular types of fruit called baobab, which I'll talk about in a second. But they're really not eating what we think of as vegetables, like kale, broccoli, cauliflower, things of that nature, for the most part. And so we've come up with this whole five fruits and vegetables rule, which is quite frankly made up. And I don't think actually really fits an ancestral diet. I actually make a contrarian point of view that fruits are more important than vegetables. The problem with modern fruits is they don't resemble the ancestral equivalents like baobab. They're like these huge strawberries and super sweet bananas and other things that we've bred that don't resemble anything like our ancestors ate. But I really don't actually think greens are a huge necessity in the diet. There's lots of cultures that don't eat a lot of vegetables, and they're healthier, quite frankly, than most average Americans. So like I said, it's a nice to have. I'm not saying a salad is unhealthy, but there is clear evidence that, for instance, people who are like shoving, you know, handfuls of spinach into their green smoothie, thinking that they're a super health nut, are getting excessive amounts of oxalates, which are very high in things like spinach and kale, and they actually develop issues like kidney stones. So more is not better actually with vegetables, because plants essentially have a lot of what are called anti-nutrients. Plants essentially don't have any defense mechanisms like animals who can run away from you. So they have chemicals in them that prevent you from eating them or overeating them. That's why like 95% of plants are essentially poisonous. We've selected the ones that essentially aren't, and we selectively eat those. But very few fruits are essentially poisonous because we want the fruits are sort of have a synergistic relationship with humans. They want to be eaten because we obviously digest the seed, poop it out, and grow the next generation of those fruits. So I actually make a very strong argument. Ironically, if you're going to eat one of these fruit powders, I prefer the red powders over the green powders. And that's because the red powders are based on essentially dried berries, which we know are ancestral and healthy. Berries are very, you know, it's my number one recommended fruit is, you know, blueberries, blackberries, strawberries, generally low carb, a lot of micronutrients, pretty healthy things compared to some of these green fruits. So I don't recommend athletic greens for that reason. But actually, my suggestion as a substitute, if you're looking for sort of like a powdered supplement to make up for sort of something in your diet, I think the number one thing that's actually lacking in American diets is fiber, ironically. Now, you can get that obviously from eating a lot of vegetables, but like I said, you get a lot of the anti-nutrients from it. So what I think is a superior source of fiber is actually fruit. As I mentioned, you want a fruit that's not too sugary and is more natural in the sense of it being ancestral. And I think the best example of that is baobab. Baobab is essentially 50% fiber. It hasn't been genetically modified. It hasn't been bred over thousands of years. It's essentially the same thing as they've been eating it for 10,000 years. It's powdered naturally. It actually dries as a powder on the fruit. And you can buy it in powdered form on Amazon. You essentially make it just like you make matcha, if you're familiar with matcha green tea. You just whisk it or blend it with like a hand blender. You can even spoon blend it in water. And it almost serves essentially the same function as athletic greens, but it's way cheaper. So as opposed to paying $100 for 30 servings or $3.33 a serving for athletic greens, you can buy, you know, a 12-ounce bag of baobab for $10 to $15 on Amazon and, you know, get basically 5 grams of fiber and a 10 gram scoop. It's also incredibly high in micronutrients, including potassium, magnesium, and calcium, which are critical to body function. And it has actually the highest ORAC score, or essentially antioxidant score, of any natural compound that I know of that's not like a very particular herb like cloves that you can't overeat. It's in the hundreds of thousands. So instead of basically buying a super processed green powder that they've mixed 100 ingredients in and has a high likelihood of heavy metal toxicity or contamination. Just have baobab as one ingredient. It's just the fruit and provides, I would argue, a lot of the benefits with much less of the downsides. So I suggest that as a single ingredient, unprocessed or very minimally processed alternative. So look into baobab instead of these weird green powders that are being promoted. So anyway, that's my health tip for today.
Hey, Cameron, what's the best natural process to maybe increase that testosterone? Because I'm more so like in the vegan / pescatarian space. So like I kind of get what you're saying about the overusage of vegetables and things like that too. But how do you... to kind of get back on topic, like how do you utilize maybe the foods and stuff that we're eating to enhance the testosterone?
Yeah, great question. Unfortunately, the diet that you selected is not optimal for testosterone. I don't recommend vegan diets to anyone. Unfortunately, it's not optimal for testosterone and sperm production. I think if you're going that route, it's far superior to eat at least a vegetarian diet and consume as much eggs and dairy as possible, because your brain and your body need animal fat, and you just can't get it from plants. Vegan diets are not natural, and they need artificial B12 supplementation in order to prevent nutritional deficiencies. I think you can be a healthy vegetarian. It's still not optimal, but at least you're not going to have gross, essentially nutritional deficiencies. So I had actually someone on Twitter who talked to me today who's a vegetarian, and I was like, asked me a similar question. I was like, look, eat as much eggs and dairy as possible, because the saturated fat, specifically the cholesterol content, is critical. Cholesterol is essentially the nutrient that is the precursor to all of your hormones. If you look at essentially the cascade of hormones that is created, it all starts with essentially cholesterol. And unfortunately, cholesterol has gotten a really, really bad rap because people have confused dietary cholesterol with the serum cholesterol. And just because you eat cholesterol doesn't mean your cholesterol levels are going to skyrocket in a bad way. In fact, there's studies where they've had people eat like 10 eggs a day for 30 days, and it doesn't ruin their cholesterol levels like most people think. As I've talked about in previous shows, the HDL or so-called good cholesterol goes up, which is not a bad thing, obviously. And then LDL may go up, but it's not necessarily associated with negative cardiovascular health outcomes. It depends on the particle size of the LDL. And so I think they've gotten an unnecessarily bad rap. I think people can basically eat as much eggs as they'd like, to be honest with you. And if you're eating like healthy dairy, especially fermented dairy, like full fat, strained Greek yogurt, those are superior choices in that help ensure that you're getting cholesterol and saturated fat. Since you specifically mentioned pescatarian, again, I don't think there's any reason to exclude red meat. It's another common confusion. There's zero randomized clinical trials that show that red meat is associated with negative health outcomes or cancer. In fact, it should be the staple of your diet. Most hunter-gatherers, as I mentioned, eat large mammals that are red meat. And there's nothing unhealthy about it. So, but if you are going to eat pescatarian, I actually highly recommend shrimp as a food source. Eat as much shrimp as possible if you're not going to eat all the other stuff. Shrimp, in addition to eggs, is actually one of the highest sources of dietary cholesterol, as I mentioned. And they've similarly done studies where they overfeed people shrimp as a staple, and their cholesterol levels are just fine. Again, HDL goes up. That's the healthy, good cholesterol. And LDL levels, at least the ones that we care about, don't get hugely negatively affected. The other really nice benefit of shrimp is it's almost all protein. There's very little fat to protein. And so it's a nice way of getting sort of like a lean meat in. I also find it particularly delicious. So if you particularly like the taste of shrimp, obviously don't like bread and fry it because that's going to ruin it. But just sauteing it so that it's lightly cooked, have it with a little bit of marinara sauce or however you like to prepare it, will make sure that you're getting enough dietary cholesterol in order to stimulate your enough hormone production, including testosterone. So I guess that's my long answer to your question. Given your diet, the best thing you can eat is possibly shrimp, and I would eat it all the time. If you can afford it, wild shrimp is better. Otherwise, try to find like well, sustainably sourced farm shrimp. Best source for that is Costco. Costco actually like regulates its suppliers, and I think does a good job of like making sure that they're not throwing tons of antibiotics and other stuff in the water. So that's what I would do in the short term. In the long term, I would consider changing your diet, unless you have very strong religious reasons or other reasons for why, because it's just not going to be optimal for your health and your hormones. The third thing that I would look into, is obviously we have an entire program that's dedicated to optimizing testosterone. By the way, I don't like the whole natural ways, the whole distinction between natural and artificial is completely made up. I think what the real question is, what's safe and what's effective? That's the only thing that you should be asking yourself. And what we do in our program, it's a combination of medications. And the people might ask, like, why take a medication to increase your testosterone? Because no matter what you do that's natural, it's not going to significantly increase your testosterone beyond your baseline levels. The second thing is your baseline levels are half of what they should be. As I've talked about on previous shows, there's a testosterone and sperm count epidemic. You basically have 50% of the testosterone and sperm that your father and your grandfather did, mostly because of obesity and also because of endocrine disrupting chemicals that are in our environments. And so the only way to restore them is really to fight fire with fire, which is it's a chemical pollutant and we need chemicals to help correct that. There's nothing wrong with that. And so we use a doctor prescribed prescription medication in very low but effective dosages. And it can, for most people, double testosterone levels, which is beyond anything that you can do non-pharmacologically. It works very well. And believe me, if there's a way that you could just quote unquote naturally increase your testosterone as effectively, I would be promoting it, but there's not. The reality is like pharmacological drugs that are safe just work really, really well. And none of the supplements or natural herbs don't do anything for testosterone in any clinically meaningful way. So unfortunately they're like mostly snake oil. So we use a prescription medication. We do use an additional supplement that helps regulate estrogen metabolism, and then we do health coaching. And so as part of the program, we don't just rely on drugs. We help people fix their diet, fix their exercise, fix their sleep, fix their focus. And then we do that using social accountability. We put people into small online groups of other men, and they check in daily to weekly, and they work on these health behavior goals with each other to make sure that they're, you know, functioning their best. Those will at least make sure that their testosterone's at the baseline of where it should be genetically. And then the pharmacology enhances or boosts it even beyond their genetic potential. And so it makes sure that, you know, if you're genetically or environmentally limited, you can still achieve high or optimal testosterone levels to look, feel, and perform your best. So I would encourage people who are listening, don't be afraid of like the term sort of natural versus unnatural. It's completely arbitrary in medicine. Everyone takes, if you take anything that's a supplement, it's not natural, yeah, even if it's extracted from a plant because it's been processed. So I think it's a made up term that people use to sort of feel better about themselves and that they're doing things. I think the real question is it, if you're talking about foods, yes, I would say eating relatively unprocessed foods should always be the goal. But when it comes to medicine, you want it to be processed. You want it to be extracted. You want it to be pharmaceutically pure, so that what you're taking is effective, right? Like an example I always give is like aspirin is a quote unquote, originally a natural product. It's from willow bark extract. Now you can go chew a bunch of bark in order to get pain relief, but you don't know if that bark has enough of it, how much bark to chew. But when you take 325 milligrams of Bayer brand aspirin, you know exactly what you're getting and you know it's effective and you know it's pharmaceutically pure. And there's a reason that we take medicine. It's because it works. And so I would encourage people to like think about, like I said, your food should be unprocessed. Your drugs should absolutely be processed because they're two different things and they serve two different purposes.
Hey, Dr. Cameron, this is Sri. You just mentioned about natural versus artificial. Once and for all, can you just help us understand the organic versus non-organic choices? Fruits and vegetables. Should I try to peel my apple, or should I just put that dirty dozen and sweets? I don't know whatever that is called now.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I do think organic actually does matter. And the reason is because of obviously like the pesticides that are used. The only thing is, so there's two caveats to that. Is it depends on what it is that you're eating. Because some things, like most of the nutrients, like the example that you gave, most of the nutrients in apples are actually in the peel, right? So ideally you want to eat the apple peel, but you don't want to eat the apple peel if you have a non-organic apple, because it has a lot of pesticides. It's also probably slathered in wax or whatever sort of food protective sealant that they put on it these days. Now, if you have a organic apple and you rinse it off in water and wipe off, the wax, ideally you do want to be eating the peel. And so yes, with foods that have a peel that is consumable, and the fruit has a lot of pesticides that are commonly used in its production, then yes, you absolutely want, if you can access it and afford it, it's better to eat organic. So like apples, the berries that I mentioned, all the berries that you eat should ideally be organic because they spray too much of them. Now there are some fruits where there's a peel obviously that you don't want to eat. A great example is an avocado. Nobody eats avocado peel. Avocados, it's okay that they're actually not organic because they don't require a lot of fertilizer because they have a thick peel. Insects don't get into it too much. They don't, and you're not eating the peel anyway. You scoop it out and you discard it. And so you can be picky. Like it is obviously cheaper to buy non-organic avocados. I buy non-organic avocados from Costco. It has the choice and I can afford it. But I've looked at the research. It doesn't seem like it's a big deal. And so, yeah, that you want to be basically selective about it. And there's other examples as well. Some of like the more rare exotic fruits, like Costco actually carries rambutan, if you're familiar with that, Southeast Asian fruit. It doesn't require pesticides actually to grow in Mexico, interestingly, because it's like there's not a lot of like native insects that eat it. And so I looked into it and it's not organic, the kind that they sell, but they said it's not organic, but they don't use any pesticides anyway. So it doesn't really need to be certified as organic. So that's another example of something non-organic that you don't need to buy as organic. The second thing that I wanted to mention too is organic can be a bit misleading. Sometimes farmers essentially get around the organic label by using other things that aren't necessarily classified as pesticides, but they'll use like orange oil and other things that maybe they're better in some degrees than pesticides, but this is like the example as well. If you extract and refine orange oil and get D-limonene, it's essentially a chemical at that point, and then you're spraying it all over your plants. And if you consume that in large quantities, who knows what the effects of that are. Is that natural or is it artificial? From the perspective of organic labeling, it is considered natural because technically it originally came from a plant. It wasn't a synthesized chemical in a lab. But it's essentially processed and it's almost artificial. So farmers cleverly, kind of go around that and use those sprays in order to be classified as organic. But they're basically almost spraying it with just like a, different version of a what's functionally a pesticide. So don't overly rely on just like organic automatically means safe or non-organic automatically means it's dirty. Unfortunately, you do have to do a little bit of research in figuring out for that particular fruit, do they use heavy pesticides or do they not? And same thing, are you going to eat the peel or are you not? And you can use that to make better buying decisions. The good news is like, once you've kind of done the research once, like just like what I mentioned about avocados, I don't think about it on a regular basis. I'm like, great, non-organic avocados, I can buy those. Berries, I buy organic. And then, it becomes pretty simple after that. So do a little bit of research up front, make your little grocery list and go from there. That's what I would suggest.
Yeah. So I've read five. Hey, Cameron.
Hi there.
I've read Fiber Field. It's by Will Bolishewicz, but he basically talks about like what you were saying earlier with the fiber. Now, my question is there's some foods that are like misleading with like, the labels and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you figure out what's worth eating and what's not? Because if there's stuff like that, and there's a lot of things you have to go through and figure out what you should be doing.
Yeah, it's such a great question. It's kind of a funny thing. If you step back for a second, it's like, how did we get to a point in our history where we don't know what to eat? Like, it's literally almost like the most fundamental question as a human being, which is like, what do I eat in order to stay alive and stay healthy and be able to reproduce? And we've created so much confusion and there's so much debate about it. That's the thing that's crazy to me is like, we have such advanced science. We have like mRNA vaccines that can like reduce your likelihood of getting COVID, but we can't sit there and agree on what human beings eat. Ironically, there's less debate about what your pets, like your dogs and cats eat, which is, by the way, meat. Like, there's like no controversy if you ask veterinarians that like the primary food of dogs and cats is like, well, first of all, cats are obligate carnivores. They can only eat meat. And dogs are essentially primarily meat eaters. They've evolved to be able to eat some of our scraps. And so they can eat a little bit of starches like breads and things. But they're still primarily meat eaters. Ironically, that's a controversial statement in human beings. But the reality is it's the same thing. Like if you think about it, like dogs and humans essentially co-evolved. And so basically what we eat is what they eat and what they eat is what we eat. And so here's some very helpful rules of thumb in terms of how do I pick what to eat in terms of food. So if you just start on the first principles, which is the most important macronutrient that you need to eat is protein, right? I don't even really consider something a meal unless it has protein. That's why I was saying like Athletic Greens is not a meal or a meal replacement. So that's premise number one is try to get enough protein. How do you know what's enough protein? So take your body weight. And if you're obese, take your ideal body weight or what you should be, what you were in high school or what you look and feel, you know, good at. Multiply that by 0.82, right? So your body weight in pounds by 0.82. And that's basically how much protein you need to eat in order to maximize muscle building. So maintain your lean body mass, but also build it if you're doing strength training, which everyone, both men and women, should do. There's a lot of good research that shows that basically after 0.82 grams per pound of body weight, there's what's called diminishing marginal utility, meaning you don't get any additional benefit from consuming more protein over that amount. It doesn't mean it's dangerous. It just means that it's extraneous. It doesn't really provide any additional benefit, right?
Right.
So that is like the number one thing that you should be doing is just make sure that let's just do like simple math. You're 175 pound, you know, male. So multiply that by 0.82. And so 144 grams of protein. So you don't need to sit there and count your calories, but I actually encourage everyone to do it for a couple days just to know if you are on track. And then once you are, you can just kind of eat the same or similar things to do. So that's the number one thing that you should do. Target protein. Try to get 144 grams in that particular case for 175 pound male. How do you get enough protein? Eat meat. Eat meat, eat eggs, and eat dairy because animal-based protein is far superior, and the research is unequivocally clear on this, in terms of the bioavailability of protein. Milk and whey protein have DIAS scores, which is a way of essentially quantifying the quality of protein that's over 100. So on a scale of like 0 to 100, the scores are like 100 plus. All the other plant-based proteins, soy protein, pea protein, which is what Athletic Greens, by the way, uses, are clearly inferior, essentially. So you want to get your protein from meat, from eggs, from dairy, and you want it to add up to 0.82 grams per pound of body weight. Second thing that you should be targeting is fiber. People essentially don't get enough fiber. Average American should probably be consuming 20 to 30 grams of fiber. And like I said, you should be trying to get it mostly, in my opinion, from fruit and grape. Sure, if you want to get it from some vegetables as well. Fruit and tubers, I should say. Tubers are kind of below ground storage vegetables. So you want to be making sure that you're getting those. And the third thing, this is a little bit harder to measure, but I actually argue potassium is the most important micronutrient. If you're getting enough potassium in your diet, you're basically almost assuredly getting all the other vitamins and minerals. Potassium is not something you want to supplement with. You want to get it naturally from food. Actually, the recommended daily intake of potassium for the average adult is 4.7 grams or 4,700 milligrams. Almost nobody I know actually gets that. It's really, really hard. You have to eat a really like healthy diet in order to get anywhere near there. That's actually why I recommend baobab, because it's massively high in protein. If you consumed 50 grams of baobab over the course of a day, you should just split that up because you don't want to consume too much fiber at once. It's going to cause GI issues. You'd get about 1.15 grams of that 4.7 grams. If you eat one avocado, you'll get 1 gram of potassium. So I generally recommend people, if you can, eat one avocado a day. It's a great source of potassium. So if you add all those things up, you'll start to get to kind of the 2 to 3 grams of potassium range. And then you're basically making sure that you're getting enough of those micronutrients in addition to the macronutrients. So I generally kind of use those three metrics, protein, fiber, and potassium, as a general rule of thumb about whether your diet is set essentially healthy or optimally correct. Because if you're getting enough protein, you're getting enough fiber and enough potassium, it's almost assured, like unless you're doing something really weird, that you're eating a pretty optimal diet. So like I said, get your protein from meats, eggs, and dairies. Get your fiber and your potassium from fruits, from tubers, and occasionally from some vegetables. And final sort of rule of thumb, try to get it from unprocessed or minimally processed food as much as possible. Our previous caller sort of asked about like, you know, looking at nutrition labels. Here's the thing, real food doesn't have any labels. If you think about meat, fruit, and vegetables or any produce, they don't have a nutrition label because, you know, a banana is a banana. It doesn't need a nutrition label to explain what it is. It doesn't need an ingredient list. There's only one ingredient. And minimally processed food like yogurt, it's just like milk and culture, essentially. There's two ingredients. So if there's only a few ingredients, they're clear what they are, and it's something that you can make at home or something that people have made at home for thousands of years, like yogurt, cheese, butter, those are minimally processed foods. Those are also healthy choices. So nobody's going to eat 100% unprocessed or minimally processed, but the average American only eats 33% unprocessed food. So we want to, you know, change that ratio and increase that percentage from 33 to as close to, I would argue, at least two-thirds up to 80% plus, and really try to cut down on the ultra processed foods to minimal amounts. Like a chocolate bar would be like an ultra processed food. But on the other hand, such a little treat, a little bit in moderation, you know, is not an unreasonable thing to eat. It obviously shouldn't be the bulk of your diet. Last and final rule that I think is very important, cook with animal fats. The biggest thing that people are doing to harming their health is they're eating refined seed oils. You shouldn't be cooking in soybean oil, peanut oil, canola oil is probably the most common. That's essentially what all restaurants use because it's cheap and it's did not exist prior to 50 years ago. You can't squeeze a soybean, as Mark Sisson posted the other day, and get soybean oil out of it. It has to be like chemically extracted with hexane and other chemicals, which has a lot of other issues along with it. So I recommend people cook with ghee, which is basically clarified butter. You can also use tallow or lard, which is from cows and pork. There's nothing unhealthy about it. It's rich in saturated fat, which is good for you. And it's very stable. So it chemically doesn't alter when you cook it, unlike a bunch of other seed oils. Now, there are some rare exceptions. There are some plant-based oil that are okay to cook with. Coconut oil is okay to cook with if you don't mind the taste. But you have to cook it at lower temperatures. It starts to burn in the 300-degree range. And then avocado oil is a weird exception. It's not a seed oil. It's actually technically a fruit oil. It is from the actual flesh of the avocado. And so if you have real avocado oil, make sure it's real. It's not fake. There's a bunch of fake avocado and olive oil on the market, essentially. Costco and Trader Joe's are actually validated sources, so you know the stuff from there is real. You can also cook an avocado oil. There's some really fancy stuff these days, like algae oil that also has a high smoke point of 500 degrees, but I don't particularly recommend it. But if you don't have access to ghee or tallow, or you're a vegetarian and you don't eat animal-based oils, I would say avocado and algae oil are a reasonable substitute, but they're my second choices. So those are basically my nutrition tips in terms of how to eat healthy and try to keep it simple without going crazy.
Thank you, Cameron. Absolutely. Hey, Cameron, thank you so much for sharing all of this information tonight. I recently discovered sort of the dangers of nightshades.
Yeah.
I wanted to know if you could share that with us or the audience. I've been off of it for, I've been avoiding nightshades for over 6 months now, and I feel great. And I don't know if I particularly had a sensitivity, but I've seen a lot of interesting information out there, and just wonder what you thought.
Yeah, so for folks who are not familiar, the nightshades are a class or family of plants that are related to one another. They're a family of essentially flowering plants, but they encompass a lot of different things. So like the most common of which are like nightshade vegetables are like tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, peppers, things of that nature. Now, here's the thing. Nightshades originally, like if you look at their sort of ancestral, variations from which all of these, foods that we eat now derive from, they're essentially poisonous. What human beings have done is they bred nightshades to not be poisonous because we kept breeding them. So they has less and less of essentially like the toxins that, made it unsafe to eat. Now, that being the case, it doesn't mean that like the modern versions, like a modern tomato is obviously not toxic. People, if that was true, the entire country of Italy would be passing away because they put tomatoes in basically everything. Now, there are some people like yourself, perhaps, that may still have some sensitivity to nightshades. Unfortunately, there's a bunch of companies out there selling these bullshit allergy tests that tell you like what foods you're allergic to. I don't think they work. I don't think they're very scientific. I don't think IgG, which is the marker that they're measuring, is a very reliable index of it. But if you, let's say you're a person that's having some significant chronic GI issues, right? You're getting inflammation, irritation, gastric upset, constipation, diarrhea, etc. And you've talked to your doctor, you've done a full medical workup, you're making sure that's not due to some primary medical condition. You can always experiment with, essentially dietary exclusion, where you can say, okay, let me see if I have a sensitivity to certain things. Like, for instance, the rarity of celiac disease is pretty low. Like, there's not a lot of people out there who truly cannot tolerate gluten, right? It's probably like single digit percentages, but there's probably a greater percentage of people who they're not intolerant to gluten, but it does cause inflammation, right? And maybe they don't feel their best. And so a lot of people find that when they stop eating gluten in terms of eating a lot of bread, they feel better. Now, it's unclear whether that's because they cut all the carbs that bread comes with or they're cutting out the gluten, but either way, they do feel better on it. So similarly, if some people like yourself find that by cutting nightshades like tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, etc., they feel better and their symptoms go away, then great. Maybe you found some things that you have a sensitivity to or maybe even an intolerance to, and you found the culprit. The one thing that I would suggest though is if you're doing that is to be very methodical about it and only change one thing at a time. Like do everything the same. Take the same medications, take the same supplements, eat the same diet, and then just remove, let's say, tomatoes. And if you feel better, then great, then maybe it's in. But then here's what I would suggest. You do what's called an ABA test. So you remove the tomatoes, you track your symptom. Well, first of all, you track your symptoms before you remove the tomatoes. Let's say you have diarrhea. You have diarrhea like on a regular basis. You don't know what's causing it. You think it's the tomatoes. You remove the tomatoes from your diet. You see if your diarrhea gets better. Great, it's been better for 2 weeks off the tomatoes. And then reintroduce the tomatoes. And if the diarrhea comes back, then it's even more conclusive that it's probably causing it. Now, it still could be caused by a placebo effect. The power of suggestion is very powerful. Obviously, as a psychologist, I'm very well aware of that. But if you kind of do this ABA or even ABAB test where you do it twice, you remove it, you introduce it, you remove it, and you introduce it, and the symptoms disappear, come back, then you have essentially done a couple trials and it's highly indicative that, okay, maybe I really just like me and tomatoes don't agree with one another. So if that's the case, then maybe you've discovered that you have an insensitivity, intolerance, or allergy to a particular food, and great, you've learned something and you've relieved the symptom. Now, the thing I want to say, though, is I think there's a little bit of too much hype around these things in the sense that giving information to all people that, like, for instance, nightshades are bad for everyone. I don't think that's necessarily the case. There are a lot of people who can tolerate them just fine. So like I said, if you're not having any symptoms in particular, you feel fine, you don't have any gastrointestinal issues, your health is otherwise good, then I don't think you need to eliminate nightshades. In fact, tomatoes are an excessively, like, or incredibly, I should say, healthy fruit. Particularly cooked tomatoes, ironically, are actually healthier than raw tomatoes. It helps increase the lycopene content, which is a very helpful nutrient, antioxidant, also good for your vision. And it's also a very strong source of potassium, as I mentioned. Like, if you're eating a can of, let's say, canned tomatoes, an avocado, and some baobab a day, that's a pretty easy way of getting like 3-4 grams of potassium. So I don't want people to walk away thinking, oh, nightshades are evil and I should never touch a potato or a tomato. You got to figure out if it works for you or not. Like I said, if you're symptomatic, you want to try it as an experimental, like, elimination diet, so to speak. Great. Try it and see if you feel better. If you're feeling fine on them and you eat them and you don't have any symptoms, don't have any guilt. I think all those aforementioned foods and nightshades, given that they're relatively unprocessed, are still relatively good foods. Like, in the grand scheme of things, the question of is it healthy, as a clinician and scientist, I always ask the question, compared to what, right? It's like, if you're eating tomatoes and eggplant as opposed to a fucking Kind candy bar, then 100%. I would always prefer someone eat like a relatively unprocessed plant, even if it's been kind of bred to be a certain way, because it's going to be 100% better than, you know, the 30 ingredients that, you know, you put in your so-called protein bar in a factory. So if that's the alternative, then I always encourage people to eat whole foods. So that's kind of my nuanced answer to nightshades.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, just put some color onto sort of what my symptoms were like.
Yeah.
It was a persistent burning in my esophagus after I would eat anything that had particularly tomatoes in it. So yeah. Tomatoes, let's say, in a sandwich or even ketchup. It was just a burning sensation, right? I think most people will probably think that it's just regular heartburn.
Right.
And I did too for a really long time. But it's not normal. You shouldn't feel like that after you eat food.
Right.
And so that's definitely what was happening to me. From what I understand, most of the toxins seem to be in the skin.
Right.
Of potatoes and tomatoes and whatnot. And so most people, other cultures, right, they skin their tomatoes and boil them. Tomatoes and potatoes.
Right,
right,
right.
And that's like normal in their dishes. And I would guess that here, to save money, a lot of companies don't do that, right? They just, you know, it costs more to peel a potato or a tomato if you're consuming it as a condiment or something.
Right.
And I think that's what's sort of been building up over the years.
Yeah, it's a good point. And it's a great example of what I say. I mean, obviously what you're reporting is not normal, right? Like food should absolutely not burn when it goes down your throat. So obviously there's a clear indication there's something wrong. And I'm glad that you're able to pinpoint what it was, and take care of that. Obviously, if you're able to eat tomatoes without, any issues, don't necessarily stop eating them. But it's a good point about the skins. Actually, if you look at canned tomatoes, as I mentioned, they do sell varieties with and without the skin. I think the reason, honestly, is a little bit more for taste. It's a little less tasty without the skin. They do have sort of like fire roasted tomatoes in which the skin is like lightly charred. And so for culinary reasons, I think that's also a reason that they include it. So like I said, it's not unhealthy if you're able to tolerate it well. And like I said, if you find that you're not, then great, skip it, whether it's the skin or the thing altogether, if it bothers you.
Hi there.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi. I have my little guy in the background, so hopefully it's not too distracting.
Oh, no worries.
Thank you.
Family's
so much.
Welcome.
Question is geared to him and his development. He's 3 years old. He's a boy.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do to support his testosterone, like, optimal levels?
Yeah, great question. I've never been asked that for such an early age, but I'm glad you're thinking ahead. I do think it's important. There's a couple of things that I would just keep in mind. And like I said, it's not to promote like over perfectionism or like an OCPD-ness about it. But you know, if we start kind of from first principles, the main thing we want to do is like not cause damage or not get in the way of nature. Like a healthy young infant or boy will naturally like, you know, mature and start to develop, you know, testosterone in an appropriate way. And I don't think we need to do any modification. Like the program, for instance, that we run at MaximusTribe.com is only for adult males over the age of 18. Nobody under 18 needs to be optimizing their testosterone because they haven't fully matured and grown, and they don't need to be like, you know, doing anything that's performance enhancing before that age. Really what you want to do is really keep things natural. The number one tip though that I would say, especially as like a young parent, is you just want to watch out for the endocrine disrupting chemicals, which I think are actually the main issue that's harming sort of both men and women's hormones today. So the number one thing I would watch out for, and this is really hard to get away from, so I always feel bad about giving sort of this advice, is plastics. And it's really tough because almost all like baby bottles, pacifiers, they're all made out of like plastics. And so it's very hard to avoid. If you can, obviously use glass, Pyrex, non-reactive, you know, bottles. It's always better than using plastics. But on the other hand, I know like convenience, cost, you know, plastics win for that reason. So that's the tip number one. It's like try to use, you know, glass and non-reactive metals in terms of the bottles and containers that you use to feed your child, because it'll minimize essentially their exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals. So that's number one. Number two is I would actually try to limit, you know, plastics that go into their mouth. So like pacifiers, as popular as they are, like not only I think are they probably not that great for teeth, according to my sort of dentist and orthodontic colleagues, but yeah, you may be ingesting plastics from it, and God knows that they're probably made in China and not really made very well. So grinding, chewing, and sucking on those things for hours a day probably releases a bunch of those, you know, BPA, phthalates, and other sort of endocrine disrupting chemicals. So don't sort of use those toys, or if you're going to use them, don't use like plastic versions of them. That's the second thing. If you are going to use plastic bottles, just be aware of like heating plastic bottles in particular. Hot milk or a hot formula, you want to be a little bit especially careful about that, because it increases the amount of chemicals that go into the bottle. The third thing, and this is one that I actually recently learned about, which I thought was fascinating, was babies, infants, toddlers get a lot of exposure, ironically, through carpet. Carpet is, you know, a lot of it is plastic or versions of plastic these days. And they're particularly coated oftentimes with like a fire retardant chemical in order to obviously prevent, you know, sort of fires, which is great for your house, but it's not great for your baby because, you know, kids love to like on their bare skin crawl around on the carpet. And so they're getting ironically a lot of exposure just from the carpet that you and I don't get, other than maybe, you know, walking around barefoot. But it's not the same as like a toddler that's like rolling around there all day. So it's not to say to prevent your kid from rolling around, but you may want to just be mindful about the amount that they're doing that. Or if they are, like put them in a little like onesie, or like make sure they have covered sleeves and other things. Like I said, don't be OCPD about it and like, you know, stress it to death. Like I'm sure I ran around on carpets a bunch as a kid. I'm fine. And most people are. But yeah, it's something to be mindful of. Like I said, you know, a lot of parents didn't even know about this stuff back in the day. And so I think the goal is not to eliminate exposure to plastics and endocrine disrupting chemicals, because that is absolutely not possible. I just don't think it is. The goal is to just minimize it, right? You just want to make sure that the load that your kid gets is not to an unnecessary degree that it's going to harm them, you know, obviously in later life. So that's what I would say I hope my recommendations like don't promote sort of a neuroticism around or overprotectiveness around children. I do think it's important that like, you know, like we are still resilient creatures. Like, you know, we'll do okay, But yeah, I would say if you can just be careful of like the food and bottle containers, be careful about like excessive like plastics in toys that they're chewing on in particular, and excessive exposure to like flame retardant carpets and clothing in particular. If you just minimize those three things, you know your kid will be ahead of the curve. That's my basic advice.
Interesting. Thank you so much. I never thought about that for sure with the carpets, especially. I'm wondering about BPA. When it says BPA, my thought is it's probably another chemical that has a. Can you please stop? So my guess is that there are other chemicals in the pasta that haven't been tested, but
correct.
Are equally as.
Yeah, that's the kind of the unfortunate thing. I think society became very aware of BPA, and that was a good thing because it promoted a lot of companies to make sure that they stop selling bottles that have BPA in it. And same thing with aluminum cans. A lot of people don't realize that aluminum cans were also coated with BPA. A lot of that's been recently removed. But now it's often replaced with just another chemical, which is like BPS. And it's unclear, in my opinion, that BPS is much better than BPA. I wouldn't necessarily like take it at its word. That's why I always think like, you know, glass and, you know, stainless steel are always the safest options, as long as they're not coated again. So for instance, in cookware, that's why I like cast iron pans, because cast iron is just literally iron. And if it does rub off into your food, you're just getting iron, as opposed to anything that's coated with a nonstick coating, like Teflon. Is highly likely to essentially get into your food and potentially cause some endocrine disrupting effects. The only exception that I know of is like maybe something that's ceramic coated, because that's non-porous, non-reactive. So that's the thing that I would watch out for. Oh, and one final tip, which is not always in obviously the mother's control, is I think most of my pediatrician colleagues are a big fan of breastfeeding. If you can, of course, as much as you can sort of naturally breastfeed. Breast milk is essentially provides the optimal nutrition for hormone production. And I don't think, unfortunately, formulas, which use a lot of refined seed oils, canola oil, literally sugar, are optimal. Now, is it better than nothing if you're not able to provide sufficient breast milk production on your own or due to, you know, working? Then obviously it's a great substitute. And, it's still obviously an effective use, but I do think trying to maximize just sort of natural breastfeeding and production is always going to be optimal because nature already has the best solution.
One more, I don't know if that'll take up too much time, but when you talk about the endocrine disruption, personally, I was originally diagnosed, I think it was about 25 at the time, with hypothyroidism.
Mm-hmm.
And I am currently no longer diagnosed. And I remember asking my medical doctor, thinking it was genetic, and his explanation was they weren't sure. Nobody really knew at that particular point, especially. So whether it was environmental or genetic or whatnot. So there was this thing. Okay, so this is what I want to run by you. It could even be dangerous. I have no really idea. But there was on YouTube an endocrine cleanse. So what it is, I don't know if it was like one lime. I can't remember how much Himalayan salt.
Yeah.
And it's also like carbonated water. I arguably melt the salt.
Yeah. So let me just chime in here with this topic. So yeah, I mean, the thyroid issues are very complex. I generally recommend that people go work with a specialist to make sure that if they are having thyroid issues, that they're being tested and treated properly, because it is very complex. As you said, there's genetic components, there's other factors at play. You really want to like work with a specialist. It's not something that I would self-diagnose or self-treat. I just think there's a lot of room for error, with that. I have a specialty in anxiety disorders, and for people who are like, chronically highly anxious and there's no particular reason or cause for it, like they're not worried about anything but they feel anxious anyway, I always like recommend they go get their thyroid checks, because some people who have like excessive thyroid hormones, it actually may be causing physiologically their anxiety, even though they're psychologically kind of calm. So I would say always work with a doctor, and kind of, especially with that thyroid stuff is tricky and you want to be working with a specialist. I would be very hesitant to get information off of YouTube unless it's from a clinician. And I generally find the idea of sort of cleanse and detoxes for the most part to not be very scientific. So it might produce a nice, delicious drink, but it's probably not going to do anything for your thyroid or your endocrine system, generally speaking.
Thank you, Dr. Cameron. So I'm a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. and I have a question related to testosterone, serum testosterone, the relationship between serum testosterone and libido and sexual desire,
mm-hmm.
In men with and without depression. What's your opinion of that relationship?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think there's an association between testosterone and libido. And there's, both associational data in that people with higher testosterone levels tend to have, more satisfaction with their sexual function and libido. And there's also interventional data as well, in the sense that when you do hormone optimization, like our clinic does, you see improvements. So for instance, especially with the drug compound that we use and clomiphene, about 75% of patients report improvements in, erectile function if they were having trouble with that due to the increases in testosterone that they get. Now, your question about is it mediated by depression is a really good question, right? In the sense that libido is very complex. Like if you're having libido issues, it may or may not be a function of your testosterone. It could be secondary to your point to depression. It could be secondary to some relationship issues that you're having. It may be because of chronic stress and cortisol levels, and it may be all of the above, right? Libido is truly a mind-body phenomenon, and it can't even really be simplified into one biomarker and say, oh, testosterone is libido and libido is testosterone. Doesn't work like that. I wish it did. I wish it was that simple, but unfortunately it doesn't. So here's the tricky thing. Like if someone has depression, and let's say they have low testosterone, will testosterone, improving their testosterone, like with Maximus, improve their libido? I would say more likely than not, it will. But if their depression is pretty serious and that's the primary cause of their libido, then maybe not. Now, here's the other complicating factor of it. So obviously, you want to make sure that you're treating that person's depression, and not just their testosterone. So obviously, doing cognitive behavioral therapy or other evidence-based therapy and or appropriate psychiatric medication if they have severe depression, such as an SSRI, as indicated by a psychiatrist like yourself, might get them to improve their depressive symptoms and thus kind of more organically improve their libido. The interesting literature that's emerging is the psychiatric effects of testosterone itself. And one of the interesting things that we're finding is because we actually use PHQ-4, which is a evidence-based assessment of depression and anxiety symptomatology. And we actually find that, the majority of our patients actually report improvements in depression or anxiety from being on the protocol. So I don't think there's any strong evidence to make this conclusion yet. I think it'll be interesting as we collect more data, but I suspect that there are some folks that actually see an improvement in their depression from the testosterone increase themselves. And thus that, if that's the primary driver of their libido issues, might also address it that way. So what I'm saying is testosterone may improve libido, but testosterone may also improve depression, which thus may also improve libido, going through sort of the depression pathway and improving depressive symptomatology. That's a hypothesis. Like I said, we have some preliminary evidence that's pointing in that direction, but I don't think it's conclusive yet. Like, we don't obviously market or promote our treatment as a treatment for depression. I don't think that would be clinically responsible yet until we have publications that promote it. But anecdotally, I will tell you clinically that a lot of people do report mood improvements from having their testosterone optimized. And often when people's mood improves, so does their libido, because obviously a lot of these things go very hand in hand.
Excellent answer. Thank you.
If you want to join, by the way, our community, it's free. You can join our community at discord.maximustribe.com. We offer a hashtag coaching channel. If you're interested in self-improvement, you want to make some of these diet, exercise, sleep focus changes that we talked about on today's show, you can join a community of men who provide mutual support to one another and daily accountability to making sure that they're hitting their goals and being the optimal guy that they can be. And if you're obviously interested on the pharmaceutical side of things and you want to see your testosterone levels significantly increased, you can also check us out at clubhouse.maximustribe.com. We actually set up a special URL for our listeners today, so that we can provide a customized offering for you. Again, that's clubhouse.maximustribe.com. And you can also follow me on social media. All of our social media handles are at Maximus Tribe. That's the name of our community, Maximus Tribe. You can follow us there, and you can follow me personally on Twitter and Instagram. My handle is Dr. Cam Rx, DrCamRx. So thank you for spending this hour with me today. I'm always happy to answer any questions. And if you want me to address any on next week's show, just submit them to me on social media, and I'll prioritize them for next week. In the meantime, be happy, be healthy, and have a great rest of your week.